In dealing in this chapter 5, 21 to 6, 9, it is a section that many of you have heard of me speak on several times before, and so I thought I would tackle it in a different fashion than I normally do. I will still make the same basic points. For the sake of highlighting the few basic principles that I wanted to, most of the illustrations will come from the marriage section rather than the children section or the slave master section. There are several reasons for that, but I won't go into it. The topic sentence of the whole section is verse 21. That point seems to be rarely made by anybody, but it's an important one, and I am more persuaded than ever that it is true. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ is the heading of the next three paragraphs of the whole passage that was read for us tonight by Louise. Each of us is to be in subjection to each of us. He then sets out a household code, and we have other examples of household codes both inside and outside the New Testament where basic human relationships are discussed, and that is what is discussed here. However, the basis of our household code is, not surprisingly being a Christian one, is Christ. You see Christ coming throughout the whole passage, that our relationships with each other are a reflection or an example of our relationship with Christ. So, for example, verse 21, our subjection to one another is out of our reverence for Christ. Or the word there is out of our fear of Christ. Christ and the church, the great model upon which the marriage structure is built. That the husband is to love his wife as Christ loved the church, that the wife is to be submissive to her husband as the church is to be submissive to Christ. The whole marriage relationship is caught up as an analogy of Christ and the church. Or Christ and the church is an analogy of the husband-wife. It's hard to pick which is of which, but either way, our relationship between husbands and wives is based on our understanding of Christ and his relationship with his people. Likewise, chapter 6 in the children and parents one, children are to obey their parents in the Lord. I don't think that means that they are to obey their Christian parents, but obedience is the right and appropriate behaviour for Christian children. Likewise, the parents are to raise their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Or when you look at the slave is to work obeying his master as if his master was Christ. Verse 5 of chapter 6, slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters with fear and trembling in singleness of heart as to Christ. Because they are working, they're doing their work always as to the Lord and not to men. Likewise, masters in their treatment of their slaves are to treat them remembering that they have a master. The word master there is a quite accurate translation, but it misses some of the connotation. If I tell you that it's the same word for Lord, it is that word. It's a pity that the translators didn't continue to use the word Lord, so you'd get the point more clearly. That lords are to treat their slaves remembering that they too have a Lord, namely Jesus. So you see that the household rules have as their basis and their point of departure the whole thing that makes them so Christian, that it's got to do with Christ, that the relationship we're having with each other is really a reflection, is a part of the pattern of the relationship we're having with Christ. That the two are intricately connected. Now, the basic pattern that rules all of them is the pattern of subjection. I suggest that to you from the point of the topic sentence. However, you'll notice it in that the six groups of people are all called to be subject to each other. That is, husbands are to be subject to wives, wives are to be subject to husbands, children are to be subject to parents, parents are to be subject to children. Slaves are to be subject to masters, masters are to be subject to slaves. Each are called to subject themselves to the other. The word to subject is the idea of placing yourself in subordination underneath, putting yourself at the disposal of the other person. It may involve obedience, but that is only one way in which you subject yourself. There are other ways of placing yourself in subjection to another person, putting yourself out for them. Now, the subjection comes in a series of different matters. Firstly, though, it needs to be said that it is an attitudinal thing. You haven't got many prescriptions here as to what you are to do. It doesn't say, for example, here that wives are to do the washing up, does it? Or that husbands are to put the garbage tin out. doesn't give you the details of actions that are appropriate to men and appropriate to women. You know, that's woman's work. Does not come into it. But rather the attitude that the husband is to have to the wife and the attitude the wife is to have to the husband, or the attitude that the slave is to have to his master and the master is to have to his slave. It's got to do with attitudes. But each of them, in their attitudes, are one of subjection. Now, the manner of subjection will differ. For the child, let's pick on that one first, in chapter 6, 1 to 4, the child, their manner of subjection is to be obedient, as the commands of the Old Testament direct them. The parents are to be subject to their children too, but not in obedience to their children, although that seems to be a current passion, but rather they are to subject themselves to the children, and they don't discipline them, discipline their children for the sake of their own ego or the sake of their anger, but they discipline their children for the sake of the children. It's not just negative discipline that is being meant up there, it's nourishment and instruction in the Lord. That is, they act in relationship to their children for the benefit of their children. And so they just don't provoke them to anger by satisfying their own particular quirks. So to be a parent in a Christian sense really requires a lot of restraint, of putting yourself out for the benefit of your children. In this company I've got a fair degree of ability to speak with authority. In most companies I have very little, only having practiced the art for some 5 years. But it's not just that you have to restrain yourself from disciplining because you're angry and tired. It also is that you actually have to take steps to discipline. For it's very much easier just to spoil the child, to let them go ahead and do their own thing and not take any action to correct them and to teach them the ways of God. To actually spend time sitting down and reading them the Bible and teaching them to pray and instructing them in the way of the Lord, as we read in Deuteronomy chapter 6 that the godly father should be doing, is a very difficult and onerous task. It's much easier for me to say, I'll go out the back and I'll watch my television. That is the easier thing. But it requires subjecting myself to their interests. Now, each of these relationships, it involves subjection. The slave is to subject himself to his master by heartfelt diligence. The master must subject himself to the slave by treating the slave generously and properly, remembering that he too has a master, which is a lovely little dig, isn't it? And that you're not to threaten him. That is not the way in which you are to treat the slave, but rather you must be caring for his concerns. Oh, that more masters would do it today. Now, on the one that lands us in greater controversy than any, you will see the nature of subjection spelt out between husbands and wives. The wife's subjection is a straightforward one. In fact, the verb in verse 22 doesn't exist in the Greek text. If I was reading it just in a literalistic translation, it would read, "Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ, wives to your husbands as to the Lord." There's no, in a sense, special form of subjection. The verse 33 takes up the same point. In summary, he says, "However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." The word respects there is again the word for fear that you have in verse 21, which is the relationship that we should all have towards Christ. For the attitude that the wife should have to the husband is the attitude that she should have towards Christ. That is a most stark thing to say, isn't it? That is a startling thing, really, to think that the attitude that a godly wife will have towards her husband is to treat him as the Lord. Now, lest you think I'm overstating the point, you'll notice it here in verse 22, "Wives, be subjects to your husbands as to the Lord." And he goes on to say, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church." And in verse 24, she's to be subject in everything to her husband. It is her own husband that is being referred to, a word left out in verse 22, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands," not to husbands in general, which will give you great problems, I'm sure. Your own's hard enough, I'm no doubt. But you'll also find in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 6 that one of the ladies of the Old Testament, whose name escapes me at the moment, is it Sarah? Is commended 1 Peter 3:6, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. That Sarah is actually commended for treating her husband as Lord. That same word that you're going to use of Jesus. Now, lest you think that is peculiarly offensive what I've said, notice that I have not said anything different to what I said about the slaves. For how are the slaves to work? They are to work obeying their earthly masters as if they are the Lord. The directions that the earthly masters gives are the directions they are to follow as to the Lord. That is not to suggest for a moment that their earthly masters are Jesus or are equal to Jesus. Not for a moment. Nor would I suggest that it means that when your earthly master calls upon you to do something that is opposed to the character and will of Jesus, that you should obey them. There will come a point at which your Lord in heaven is of more importance than your Lord on earth. There will come a point at which disobedience to your earthly master is the right and appropriate thing. But that point is only the point where the will of the earthly master is in direct contravention to the will of your heavenly master. Otherwise, you are to live in subjection to your husband as if he were the Lord. Now, if that were all that were going to be said on this subject and we close shop for the night, we would be doing a great disservice to St. Paul, the Scriptures, to the ladies in our congregation, and even more to the men. Because that would only to propagate tyranny of the worst kind, seeing men are by and large sinful. Husbands are also called into subjection to their wives. Their subjection is the subjection of love. Very little to do with, of course, the romantic love of which we think marriage is made. Although some of us no longer think that way. Subjection of a loving kind is in fact a much more rigorous subjection than that which is imposed on the wife, I think. Maybe it's because I'm a husband that I think that way, but I think it is much more rigorous. Because the husband is called upon to subject himself to the wife by loving her in the same way that Christ loved the church. Now, how did Christ love the church? Firstly, he initiated the action of reconciliation. He takes the initiative, doesn't he? The church, or the people of God as they were people who in fact were in opposition and enmity with God. And yet Christ takes the initiative in making reconciliation. Any of us who are husbands tonight will know the enormous difficulty of making the first step in the process of making reconciliation with our wives. The first step is always one which involves a certain degree of humility. Much easier for the other person to make the first step. But that is part of it. Secondly, he did not wait until the church was deserving of him. But even when the church was not deserving of any favour, he came to make the reconciliation. Again, you see, that is enormously hard, isn't it? It is easy to give yourself to one who is indeed very deserving, but when undeserving, to actually make the first step towards reconciliation, when you know you're right and she is wrong, to still make the first step in reconciliation takes an enormous step into the inroads of my pride. And more, when he made this work of reconciliation, what did he do? He sacrificed everything. The whole lot had to be given. Nothing short of that. That is the way in which Christ loved the church. That is the way in which the husband is to love his wife. There is nothing except Jesus himself that the husband will not give up for the sake of his wife. He must be willing and able and ready to lay down everything that he has ever thought, hoped, aspired to, possessed, owned or wanted. That must all be laid at the feet of his wife. So total is his submission and subjection to her. I reckon he has the hard end. Myself. Now that is the subjection that he is called upon to do. Because she is his body And he is to so care for her as he cares for his own body. We preen our bodies, we wash them regularly, we care for them in all manner of fashion. So we are to be looking after our wives with such care. And Paul then ties the two ideas together with his idea of unity, that the two have actually become one flesh. It's God's great mystery, which we've seen throughout this epistle, to unite all men in Jesus Christ. And that is worked out most beautifully in marriage itself, that the two have become one under Jesus Christ. And as one, they are to live together in subjection to each other, in submissiveness to each other. Now, in society today, we are seeing great conflict about the patterns of social relationships. And here let me hone in on the one in chapter 5 of the husbands and wives. Because there are all types of alternative models of behaviour, alternative patterns of way of setting up the relationship between men and women. The earlier 20th century pattern of middle class Westerners anyway, where the husband went out and earned the wage and the wife stayed at home and looked after the children, is certainly under widespread challenge, if not under almost total desertion in our community. It's no longer the abiding rule that people wish to continue with or to propagate. That's under a lot of attack. But it's more than just that we've moved away from that particular model or pattern. There are all kinds of quite radical models being put up instead. Let me just pick on one, but you can think of many others. Margaret Mead came into Sydney a couple of years ago, a year or so ago, I saw her on television, you know, the American anthropologist, and she was suggesting a pattern whereby people have some trial marriages which are easy to get in and easy to get out of in their youth, but they are not allowed in those trial marriages to have any children. Then, when they are willing to take on the responsibility of children, they are to enter into a marriage for which they are not allowed to actually get out of until the last child has reached some age like 18 or 20. That is, there's no divorce at all if you're in that kind of marriage contract. After the last child has reached that age, then that marriage may be dissolved and people are free to start up some more relationships that might have to do with their living together in old age together. Now, that is a serious suggestion by a very eminent and prominent anthropologist and sociologist in our community, and it's not one that is very far from the realities of what people are doing either. I mean, she's just actually saying, let's do it legally. That is, the Americans, to pick on them, the poor Yanks, they get thrashed a lot, the Americans are leading the way that the Australians are following of actually practicing polygamy. Only difference with our polygamy is that we have it as consecutive polygamy. You don't have them all at once, you have them one after another. But it's polygamy nonetheless, is it? Isn't it? And that is a pattern which is becoming more acceptable. Or indeed, the just general non-law pattern of just shacking up together. And that many people, when they profess they're going to get married by their workmates, will be said, well, why do you do that? Why not just go and live together? That is a right and appropriate pattern and behaviour. Because then if you don't like each other, if you grow apart as the years roll on, well, you can separate without any messy divorce and life is much easier all round. Or indeed, under the persuasion of the Women's Liberation Movement, for want of better name, we're told that we're not to be any more a patriarchal family life nor a matriarchal family life, that we must always have an egalitarian family life, where all decisions are made with complete and open democracy, and where people are not given roles to play, but are treated as persons, and that that is the way in which we should conduct married life. Now, these conflicts that take place about the roles and patterns of marriage, we can argue about at great length, but we usually get nowhere because we don't realise that we're arguing from completely different bases. That is, one pattern sounds attractive to my personality, another might sound attractive to your personality. We can think up good reasons for this one or good reasons for that one. But being sinful people, that is no necessary reason for adopting any of them, I would suggest to you. That is, that I find a pattern attractive may just be a reflection of my sinfulness, may it not, seeing my natural instincts are towards sin. But that is not what the argument is about anyway. It's about upon which basis do you make a decision as to the way life should be lived. There's the real conflict. For example, do you make the decision on the basis of a descriptive analysis? That is, you look around the society and say, this is the way people are living. Therefore, that is the model we should enshrine in our law, and that is the way in which you should live. And if you don't want to live the way in which people are living, you'd rather live in the way they used to live 30, 40, 50 years ago, that's just because you're old-fashioned, right-wing and reactionary. And the quicker you free yourself from those hang-ups, the more you'll be able to enjoy life. Now, that is a kind of descriptive analysis, the type of thing that you saw in the Kinsey reports on sexuality amongst American males and sexuality amongst American females, in which the basic line, the drift that you cut, get read between the lines all the time was, this is what everybody else is doing, what's wrong with you? The what's wrong with you bit is the bit you read in between the lines. But you're hard-pressed to miss it, especially if you're not doing what everybody else you're told is doing. Or at least what they said they were doing to the investigators. Now, that's a descriptive analysis. That is the way in which we should decide how we should set up our family life. When you reflect upon it for a moment, that's a hopeless basis, isn't it? Because my neighbours want to have a fight every night, does that mean I should have a fight every night? I mean, that's a stupid way to live, isn't it? Because Johnny down the road sticks his hand in the fire doesn't say a thing as to what I should be doing with the fire or with my hand. But that is the basis that it'll get a constant drift and drip approach upon ourselves, isn't it? It's drip, 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 drip all the time. This is the way to be with it. This is the new. This is the fashionable. This is 20th century living. This is progressive living. This is the way, you know, it goes on and on and on. And you get a whole series of articles in Women's Day and Women's Weekly and New Idea and Family Circle, all the things that you spend your time reading during examinations. And every one of them, you see, has some stage personality or political personality or some personality who has decided not to marry, they'll just live together and how happy their life is, etc., etc. And 3 or 4 months later you read how they've moved on to their next one, but they're happy with this one. This is all a different scene. Much bigger, better than ever anything that's happened before. And so the persuaders of our community are operating on this descriptive analysis. This is what the with it people do. Then there is the functional analysis. This is a little more intellectual. Certainly the sociologists believe so. If you think they're intellectual, you'll be persuaded too. That is, that sex roles come out of necessity, that they have a particular function and purpose to fulfil in binding society together. Now, as society moves ahead, or behind, because of technological advancements, then so the necessities will change, and so the roles can change, because society can now be structured differently. So, of course, the great founding technological evidence, the technological achievement which established the women's liberation movement, was the discovery of the pill. That actually gave to women, and I think there's real truth in this whole analysis at that point, that gave to women a new freedom about the decisions they have to make and are able to make and make with ease on the subject of children, which have given them a new freedom concerning their work roles, which then gives them a new freedom concerning their marriage roles. And the whole revolution in thinking. When you realise that in pregnancies, women are physically handicapped, for some months, in the first few months with the morning sickness, in the last few months with the sheer weight and size, and in the first couple of months after the birth with both the feeding and with the tiredness from the effort, you can see that for a year or so, the woman's work role will be severely hampered, and help from her husband will be an obvious function of their marriage unit. When you realise that in previous generations people would have 12, 13, 14 pregnancies in their lifetime, as a fairly normal course of events. In fact, if we checked around our grandparents, you'd find that most of them have 8 or 9 brothers or sisters. They all came from big families a couple of generations ago. Some of us do from this generation, but very, very few. Right? But that was a normal. The woman would be actually pregnant and looking after little children for some 20 years of her lifespan. Then you saw the functional necessity for having a family structure as we used to have. But now, with one child, as Margaret Mead called it in the 1920 pattern, the status child, one to prove that you could. When you have the one child or the two children, when you have the whole society set up with preschool clinics, etc., that can take the child, when you have accouchement leaves which give you the 3 or 4 months off to look after that final parts of pregnancy and the early parts of the child, then the woman can continue with her career, with her working in a career and her husband working in a career. The whole nature of their relationship will be undergoing a change, and the function of the family unit being for the protection and provision of the wife while going through childbearing and raising will then change. And we go further and we do tests on women and find out that they've got intelligence too. And it's not significantly different from men's. So therefore they should occupy the same job, seeing that our whole society is based on the intelligence that you are fortunate or unfortunate enough to be blessed with. So the functional analysis is what is being talked about. They say women are as brainy as men, therefore they should do the same things as men. I actually think we will find that there are differences in women's intelligence. I think they're brainier than men in language skills and a few other things. But that aside, it seems to me that the Bible and Christians, therefore, cannot argue from either the descriptive or the functional analysis. And as long as we realise that we are arguing from a different basis, we will not find those arguments persuasive, and we will not waste our time in futile arguments with non-Christians. The basis from which we're arguing is both creation and recreation. This is the way God said he has made the world. This is the way in which he says he wants us to live. Now the question comes, who will know better? That's the question. If you're a believer in God, then you'll wind up living God's way. If you're not a believer in God, then you will find every reason possible not to live God's way. And you will find reasons, I've no doubt about that. We're all clever enough to have rationalisations one way or another for avoiding doing what we know we should. And so you'll find reasons, they'll be good and cogent, but they'll be hopeless because they're non-Christian. Let me show you their hopelessness. You see, the descriptive one, what are they doing? They are describing how sinful men live. How can that be a basis on what I should do? See, once you've allowed the possibility, indeed the certainty, that all relationships are fouled by sin, then descriptive analysis is a complete and utter waste of time. All you're describing is sin, which tells you nothing about how a Christian should live. If you want to base yourself on the Word of God, then I think you will find that there are certain functions which are of great advantage to you. And in certain periods of history, you might find that your description of marriage pattern is very similar to the Christian one. In others, you may not. Now, the pagan resolution to the whole question of the relationships are very simple. As one man I know says, women's lib will always lose because men's biceps are bigger than women's biceps. But that is the ultimate pagan resolution. You see, you resolve your relationships on the basis of power. Economic power, numbers game, manipulation emotionally, just sheer brute physical force, blackmail. You get it. You see it if you read that book by what's his name, Byrne, B-E-R-N-E, Games People Play, and the whole transactional analysis of the subtle ways in which people manipulate and coerce each other into doing what they want them to do. See, that's the pagan resolution. You can even buy books now analysing how we do it. And they're fairly accurate in their analysis of that point too. But the pagan will always resolve his relationship by power, by coercion, for that is all he has got left. Although he'll give all kinds of fancy reasonings, it will boil down to power every time. But the way of Christ is completely different. Mark 10:45. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. See, Jesus isn't calling upon wives to do anything different to what he did himself. He's not calling upon husbands to do anything different to what he did himself. What did he do? He didn't come to be served. He came to serve. To serve to the point of giving his life as a ransom for many. Or 2 Corinthians 8:9. He who was rich became poor, so that we who are poor might become rich. Or Philippians 2:5, that have this mind among yourselves, which you have in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant. At that point I'm going to have to look it up. Being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself, became obedient unto death, even the death upon a cross. See, what kind of mind should you have as a Christian mind? One that is like Christ. And what's Christ's mind like? The way to rule is by serving. Now, that's not the way the pagans rule, but that is the way the Christian will rule. And you husbands and you potential husbands want to rule your households? Well, the way to rule them is by serving them. By being the slave of every member in the household is the way to rule your household. Now, the non-Christian can never grasp that idea. That is so fundamentally, radically different to everything he's ever thought, that it will pass by his small brain in a very quick period of time. He will certainly hear, wives, be subject to your husbands. And he will say, get down there, woman, see what the Bible says, on your knees. But he will not grasp hold that the husband is to love as Christ loved, which is not to be served, but to serve and give your life as a ransom. That is service indeed. Leave Christian the question time at this stage, and let me just tell you the last 5 points on the second page there. The Christian household. I've already pointed out to you that these are dealing with attitudes, not situations. I don't think there is such a thing as woman's work. Don't think it exists. I think in some households, the woman will wash up. In other households, the man will wash up. Some households, they'll both do it. Some households, they'll do neither because they'll have a servant to do it. Can't rule what's going to be, but in the attitudes is what counts. And my attitudes will give me different situations in different contexts, won't it? See, in one situation, I will go and mow a lawn for a man to help him out. I will go and make a speech for him to help him out. I'll write a letter for him to help him out. In another situation, the way in which to help him out is to give him confidence, teach him how to do things and not do them for him. In each, I am submitting myself to him. Although in one thing, I'm doing it for him, in the other, I'm not doing it for him. But my attitude will be of submission of myself for him and his interests. It's got to do with attitudes, and it will come out in different situations. Now, point two. This is the pattern for living. Are you a slave or a master at the moment? Are you a parent or child? Are you a husband or wife? Then do what God's word says to do in the context in which you're in. That is, this is the way God wants you to live. If you disagree with my understanding of the passage, I'm happy for you to correct me, and I'll correct it next week publicly. But if this is what the passage is saying, then stop fiddling around with alternatives that the pagans have thought up to excuse their sinfulness, and get on doing with what you're told to do. You get on with loving your wives, get on with being obedient to your husbands, and treating them as Christ. Get on with your master who is set above you in the work situation, and work diligently for him. Doing the task as if he was Christ himself asking you to do it. And for those who are your servants, then go out of your way to be kind to them and generous to them, as you want Jesus to be generous to you. Thirdly, this is the pattern for self-development. For many of us, you see, we're not in these relationships yet. Many of us are not married yet. Well, firstly, start evaluating this pattern of life. When you're thinking about marriage, what does the word marriage conjure up as an idea? Well, you've read the passage tonight. Here is some of the information to give you an understanding of the pattern of marriage that you must be educating your mind with. Because secondly, what you should be doing is starting to prepare yourself for your role in that life. Unless God has laid it upon you that you are not to marry, then you better prepare yourself along the lines of 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul has the special gift. And we will hope to support you in your missionary endeavours later. But you should be now preparing yourself to be the kind of husband that Christ wants you to be by already developing the good habits of being loving, of being thoughtful, of being considerate, of being tender and gentle and everything that the pagan Australian isn't in his chauvinism. For the Australian, by and large, is a terrible pig. And that is not the way in which Australian Christian men are to be conducting themselves. But we are already to be developing in ourselves a real gentleness and consideration and concern and good mannerliness towards the women folk in our community and indeed towards all people. That we should be humble and gentle and put ourselves out for those who are in need of our strength. Or, if we are to be a wife, well then take up the passage of 1 Peter 3 where he says that the beauty of the woman, the Christian woman, is not the external adornment, but rather the gentle and quiet spirit which in God's sight is very precious. Actually start working at making yourself a woman of gentleness, of quietness. Or take up the Titus passage in chapter 2 where the older women are to instruct the younger women in the ways of godliness. And start putting it into practice. Pray for it. Think out ways in which you can exercise it. But the more you work away at doing that now, the more you are laying a good foundation for your own marital happiness. For isn't it a marvellous thing that a man should love his wife so much that he does everything to care for her, and that a woman shall take his leadership? Can you not see that would make a harmonious and peaceful relationship, a united relationship of great beauty? Well, you can work at having that even now, before you're married, before you've even met the girl that you're planning to marry. You can be working away at it now in improving your habits. And fourthly, you can use this passage as a pattern for making choices about partners. Now we're going to look at guidance in the next 3 weeks, so I suppose some of you will come back specially for that, those who are not engaged already, unless you're told that you might have made the wrong choice. But I think that's all the more reason why you should come back, isn't it? But plainly in the scriptures you're told 2 things which are absolute definites about guidance on whom you're to marry. Number 1, you're to marry somebody of the opposite sex. Number 2, you're to marry a Christian. Now that's clear and undeniable in the scriptures. So don't worry your time spending with anybody else in terms of choosing partners. You're a real utter waste of time. It gives you heartache to them and heartache to you and will achieve no proper godliness. Within that limit though, you've got free range, which gives you a fairly large fishing pool, really. Now, the Bible then doesn't leave you in total ignorance as the next step to take. For the Bible here in this passage gives you advice as to what makes for a good wife, what makes for a good husband, doesn't it? Girls, you want to marry a good husband, a good Christian man who will make you happy? Don't worry about what he looks like. He mightn't have my good looks, but that doesn't matter. It's rough. It really is hard. That will not matter. It's a matter of indifference whether he has money, whether he can drive a car well, or whether he can't drive a car. Things like that really do not matter. And in a sense we know that, but in a sense we obviously are still under the dominating power of the paganism around about us. For men are still evaluated by their looks as women are by their looks, although that is quite ungodly. It's an utter irrelevance what the partner looks like. It really just does not matter, and we should have done with that stupid paganism, which of course makes for so much money for the cosmetic factories. Rather, we should look for the husband who is a loving man. You see a Christian man who is always kind, always considerate, always going out of his way to help people when they're in need. That is the man who is a gold mine as a husband. Don't waste your time to find out if he can speak 10 languages, whether or not he can work computers, whether he's going to make a fortune or not. That man makes a good husband, irrespective of his wealth, irrespective of his health. And remember, when you marry him for better or worse, richer or poorer anyway. You don't know what's going to happen to him, but if he's a loving man, he makes for a good husband. Likewise, when you're looking for girls, what a terrible paganism that expect Christian girls to get all dollied and fancied up like the pagans in order to choose one out of the lust of the flesh, as Paul condemns in 1 Thessalonians 4. That's not the way to approach choosing the right partner. But is she a godly woman with a gentle and quiet spirit who will make for harmony and peace in your home? Is she the woman that you could actually give your life for? that they're all willing to lay down your life for her. If that's the one, then don't worry about fishing elsewhere. Get married quickly, for she is a gem indeed. Within, of course, the bounds of being Christian. So you've got, this passage gives you some ideas as to the grounds, as to the value system upon which you can make realistic choices. I've found the passage in Ecclesiastes has now given me greater confidence to encourage people to marry before they leave our church. The passage about, that just comes before, how can one keep warm in bed alone? They need two. It says that two cords are stronger than one. That is the passage, you see. People leave here married with Christians. They've got greater possibility of strength. God gives us each other to keep ourselves in strength. I'm not laying upon it that everyone must marry. However, I am encouraging you to consider it very seriously that that will be God's guidance for you. Finally, this gives you a pattern for apologetics. I don't think we should be ashamed of the Christian view of men and women. I actually think we've got good grounds for arguing here, because I think the pagan way has a fairly poor track record. Right? 50, what is it, the figures? Someone gave it to me from this congregation last time, isn't it? Admittedly, the new divorce laws come in, but 57, for every 100 marriages last year, there were 57 divorces in New South Wales. I think that's the figure. Now, of course, we're still dealing with the backlog from the build-up before the change in divorce law, but you realise that the pagan pattern really has got a very poor track record, hasn't it? That's just talking about official formal divorces. And when you present the pattern of man subjection, that is a radical thought to the non-Christian, and indeed a beautiful thought. And people can see how Christian marriage, not traditional Western marriage, but Christian marriage, may indeed be the most beautiful of all forms of marriage, and how it can work in binding and bonding two people together, as is the very pattern of Christ in uniting all men under Christ. And so I'd encourage you to use the subject as a matter of really coming into confrontation with our community around about us, always recognising in our apologetics that we have the doctrine of sin, and so we can expect to see failures, not only with non-Christians, but also in Christians, because we are sinful, and we do things that are wrong. Well, that'll give you plenty of time to talk over supper on certain things, won't it?